All right, let's continue about the auction, because there was a bear story there somewhere. That
well, one of the outfitters somewhere donated a bear hunt, and we got, I think we even got picketed out front by the animal people, and it just said he takes you on a bear hunt. It didn't say you had to shoot a gun, and so I made the point on the auction that you could shoot a camera. And I believe one of the local radio stations' morning crew bought it, and they sent somebody with a camera. And so they got a lot of pictures of bears and stuff, which turned out to be okay. But there are always people giving us things that seemed okay at the time, which somebody else took exception to.
Right.
Well, I mean, there's a bunch of different opinions of a lot of things, and a bear hunt might be great for some people. Other people might think a bear hunt's terrible. But somebody went on one that they bought from the auction and took pictures. So
let's talk about controversies. Did you have, in your tenure here, times of controversial programming where you had real big community issues or university issues?
Yes to all of those. One of the ones that I remember, I think it was early in the 80s, we were getting underwriting from Corning, Illinois Corning, I believe, up in Toledo. And the death of a princess came on. It was a story of, I guess, a young princess who had done something and the community had stoned her to death. And there are a lot of people that didn't think that should be shown. And so I had a call from somebody up in Toledo and at the Owens Corning plant and said, you know, they didn't think that program should be on. And I asked them if they had seen it, and they said no. And I said, well, you know, if you tune in Wednesday night, you'll get a chance to see it. And we had, I think, maybe one or two more years of support from them, and then it went away. And that's just one of the risks you take. Now, there were others, and there were some at the university. I remember one time on radio, a news report said something actually accurate but unfair about a person that was involved with the president of the university. And the president called me and was all upset. And I checked it out, and it was accurate, but was not necessarily fair. You take something out of context, it can still be accurate, but it's not the best way to present it. And I wanted us to present things in a fair and accurate manner and not just accurate. So we had some discussions, and I think that kind of fixed that situation. But there are always things that some people thought would be good, some people thought would be terrible. I remember we had some difficulties with the Middle East situation, where some of the programs the Jewish people thought were not giving the whole story. So we would have them come on and do one, and then we'd have the other side come on and do one. And we wanted them all to feel like they were heard. And sometimes it was touchy. And we just kept trying to do that. And then there were other times that we might try something that we thought might be controversial, and it blew us away. After the release of the information about Jefferson's heirs, we said over the air and promotion and stuff that we'd like Jefferson heirs to appear here at the Fawcett Center one Saturday. I think we had 800 people show up. We were not expecting that. And we talked to many of them and did a couple of specials about, you know, tracing your family back and what you might learn about your family and what others don't know about what your traditions are and your own lineage is. So there were always wonderful examples of things that we did, and there were always critical things that we needed to do to sort of balance. And we wanted to be balanced. That was our key.
It's always within university licensees, the balance between serving the community and serving the university, I guess. And I wonder how you sought to seek that balance.
Well, I think you could ask any of the eight presidents I worked for, and you might get a different response from each one. We always felt like we were part of the Ohio State University. We didn't make any bones about that. It wouldn't have been right to have the call letter WOSU if you were not associated with the university. But we also knew that you have to consider where your financial support comes from. And the university did provide some financial support, but it was less than 10% of our total income. And so I couldn't devote 50% of our resources to the university because I'm shorting 40% of folks who provided funding. So I think I tried to deal with presidents and vice presidents and deans and stuff that would have concern and try to figure out some way again to make sure everybody felt a part of this. We didn't want it to be separate from the university or from the community. So we were always willing to sit down and talk with anybody about doing anything. A lot of things we talked about we couldn't afford, and the people that wanted them done couldn't find resources, so they didn't get done. But it was understood that we were willing, and we were willing mm-hmm. to almost do anything that made sense programmatically as a part of this community if we could find the resources to do it. We did a lot of great things with the university, and the university was great to us. So I look back on it, feel good, and, of course, several of us taught at university, and that was unpaid, I might add. Felt like if you're going to be at a university, you ought to do everything you can to help in the educational process because it is a university after all.
Mm-hmm. I don't want you to throw anybody under the bus, but certainly you had your favorites as far as leadership within the university environment. Whoever actually directs WSU as part of the university, that has moved around a lot in the past. And you were under a college for a while, I know.
Yep.
And so can you talk about that a little bit? Because that can cause some uncomfortable situations, too.
Yes. When I came, we were under the Vice President for Educational Services, which was Catherine Shane. And Catherine was, I think, the first female officer of the university. And I thought was a wonderful, wonderful, bright lady. And we got along very well. The difficulties, the few times we had them, were where she would want us to be treated like any other educational department. And we weren't like any other educational department. Like the library would be doing something and she would want us to do something similar. Well, there are some similarities between the library and WSU, but not a whole bunch. And what they could do and what we could do would be very different. Mm-hmm. And ROTC, well, I mean, I like ROTC and all that, but we couldn't do things like ROTC was doing. But overall, we got along very well. I think after that, I'm trying to remember where we went. We were in the president's office for a while. And some of the stories, I remember one time the president sent me the United Way contributions requirement that, you know, each office got a requirement. And I got to checking on it, and we got 100% of the requirement from the president's office. Well, it turns out we were 80% of the president's office in terms of number of staff and number of dollars and all that. So he just sent us the whole thing, you know. So it's like that didn't seem right. And then we were under a dean, and Joan Huber was the dean in social and behavioral sciences. And Joan became provost and was one of the most stable, logical, bright women I've ever known. And Joan and I had almost no problems at all. Now, sometimes she'd say, no, don't do that, and explain why, and it would make perfect sense. And sometimes she would say, you know, we think you ought to do this. And when I would explain why we couldn't do that, she'd say, well, that makes sense. So we were able to discuss things and reach agreement on almost everything. When she moved over to the provost, she felt like she thought we should be there, but she thought it would show favoritism to take us, so she didn't. Well, Randall Ripley came in as the dean, and so we worked with Rip for several years. And Rip and I had almost the same relationship that I had with Joan. At some point, I think we were back in the president's office, and then I think we were They created a new vice president for university relations, and Lee Tajdin came in that position. And I think he was here, or he had just left, but was here maybe when you were hired. About that time he left and I left and you came and it's
I was actually in your office talking to you when Lee called and said he had accepted a job elsewhere. Because I remember you were there.
Well, I knew it was all right together.
It was all right together,
yes,
yeah.
Yes, it was. So and Lee was a really terrific guy. He had been PR guy, I think, at DuPont. And really a high-powered PR guy and didn't really like to be seen too much. But, boy, he maneuvered in the background and he would deal with newspapers and radio and TV and other folks in the community that would cover the university and trying to get them to do certain things and not do certain things and so forth. And I respected him quite a bit. He was a very good guy. And, of course, I said 8 presidents, so that in itself
what's your favorite?
Should get a medal. Probably 2 guys that I like personally, Harold Anderson and Ed Jennings, I liked very much as people. And Ed and I were competitive. We played in the golf league together and stuff. There's a difference in respecting somebody and feeling comfortable enough to say exactly what you think. And with Harold and Ed, I felt like I could say exactly what I was thinking. And that gave you a comfortable feeling that you didn't get with some of the others. For instance, the one I feel like, I reported to but didn't know very well was Britt. And I didn't feel
it's
like—
Kerwin.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. We didn't seemed to connect somehow. Mm-hmm. I was in his office a lot of times and talking with him, but I always felt like I wasn't really getting his full attention. And of course, he had a lot of things to pay attention to, so I'm not blaming him at all, but just, sometimes you just feel more chemistry with somebody than you do with somebody else. But I think Harold and Ed were probably the 2 that I had the best chemistry with.
Obviously, one thing that you probably struggled with, which we struggle with today, is university funding. And was that an issue all the time?
Always.
Yes.
We always wanted more, and they always wanted us to give less. And some of the presidents would even say, well, heck, all you need $50,000 is to go on there and ask for it, and they'll give it to you. Well, it's not really like that. It try to convince a president that you can't just turn on the cameras and go and ask for money anytime you feel like it. They don't know that you get programs that are shortened and you get the ability to do things in certain programs that you don't get other times of the year when you're doing fundraisers. So just pop in there tonight without all these other changes built in, you're really going to mess up your schedule trying to do fundraising. And then you're going to make people upset instead of feeling generous. They're going to feel non-generous. So it never seemed to be a factor that just made either side want to just quit. But a lot of times people on the Friends Board would feel like the university wasn't doing its part because they'd hear the demands they would place on us, and they would say, well, that doesn't make economic sense. And so they would – one set of members once went to see the president without my knowledge and said that they thought the president should transfer the license to the community and that they would take over the full financial responsibility. So they left the president's office, and he called me. I didn't know they were there. And even though I thought there were some benefits to being a community station, there were also some drawbacks. And, for instance, we would have no place to be. And if it took place in a hurry, you got to find somewhere to have your studios. And when you try to do new studios, that's maybe sometimes a multi-year thing to get everything working the way you want to. So, but it shows on the part of the Friends Board, I think, the dedication they had to the stations were willing to go up against the president to say to him, you ought to give a major department to us. We can do it better than you. Mm-hmm. And I can also see the president's demand saying, get out of my office because you don't know what you're talking about. And I can see both sides of it, but it showed both sides wanted WOSU, which, in some ways makes you feel good. But now you got to deal with the crisis, and you can worry about the good feeling years down the road. And some of the Friends Board members resigned over that because the university was not giving it up. And we quickly replaced them and got on with doing what we needed to be doing. So, but the university has financial problems too. We weren't the only ones. Now, sometimes things would be done that seemed to make it worse. There would be promises made about certain, if you do this, then we won't charge you that. And then they weren't honored. And I would be up near one of the satellites in orbit because I always tried to do what I said. And when somebody would say that, and one time in front of trustees said that and didn't do it. And then my problem is whether I tell the trustees that what you heard is not what's happening or not, and I decided not to. Because, you know, I was sure there was some good reason for that, but it left us a couple of hundred thousand in the hole when the smoke cleared. And that just didn't seem right. So, yeah, there were always problems with the university funding and probably never will go away.
Do you think one more question about the university relationship. Do you think the university, through your tenure, I imagine it was up and down as well, valued what WSU brought to the community as a land-grant university, that kind of thing?
Probably. Every year there might be a different opinion of that, depending on what was the main goal of some of the top people at university that year versus another year. Some year they thought we were doing just exactly what we should be doing. Other years we didn't do anything that they valued. But I think overall I'd probably have to give us a C in terms of the way the top administration would look at it. Some years we get an A and some years we get an F, and you know, so we'd settle in the middle. But sometimes it's very unclear as to what it is they want you to do. And so you take in all the advice and worry about your financial resources and where you feel like you owe certain things and do the best you can with all that information on hand.
Looking back, you talked about the regional FM development. Also on the radio side, this is where talk show kicked off, open line kicked off with
yes.
Lynn Neary, I guess, right?
Yes, right. And it's funny because Lynn and another male staff member here went to NPR when APRS was taking the NPR over. And the financial situation was not good, and I sort of whispered in their ear, you know, be sure you're doing the right thing because they could go under.
Yeah.
And that was my worry as a board member.
This is during the crisis in their like early to mid-80s, I think,
yes,
with Frank Mankiewicz.
Right.
And,
yes. Well,
yeah.
And see, when I was senior vice president, well, vice president of APRS when we merged with NPR. Mm-hmm. And then became vice president of NPR board or vice chairman. And then we hired Frank and Frank hired me. And so then when I came here, I went on the board and became chairman of the board. But in the 80s, I was on the board and we had let Frank go. Frank ran into a debt as well.
Right.
Multi-million dollar. And Frank was one of the best he could convince almost anybody of anything, but he couldn't change numbers, and he didn't pay attention to numbers. Numbers were just things that other people kept track of. You know, I don't do numbers, and it got us in a bad situation, and Frank had to go. and I remember in Minneapolis, I believe it was, the public radio conference, somebody stopped me in the lobby of the hotel. And TV folks. And they said, we'd like to ask you a few questions. Okay. And I noticed the camera looked like it wasn't even looking at me, looking just next to me. And they asked me these questions. Well, a few hours later, I was up in the Prima Suite, and there are 50 people in there. And somebody said, oops, come here quick. So I went in, and I was on one side of the screen, and Frank was on the other. That's why it looked like there, because they did a split screen. And they would ask us the same questions. And, boy, we were not close to each other in our answers. And the next day, Frank resigned. but the board had a vast majority of support to ask him for his resignation. And thank God we didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
It's cleaner if he does it on his own. We hired a guy named Doug Bennett, and Doug was good, solid. He's president of Wesleyan University in Connecticut, I think now, or Rhode Island, somewhere up in there.
Mm-hmm.
But a wonderful guy, and very stable and solid, and paid attention to numbers, and listened to the stations, and liked to have the board give him ideas and different opinions and stuff. So. It was a tough time when we had to let Frank go, but we got back on firm financial footing. And then almost anything you do, Tom, people have real distinctly different opinions. I tell you one. We were paying, I think, $3.2 million a year for 75,000 square feet at 25 M Street. In fact, from my office when I was there, I looked right across, and Eric Severi was cleaning out his office at 2020 M Street. That's where the CBS headquarters were. When I was chairman of the board, we were so hard up for space that we found an old American Security Bank at on Massachusetts Avenue, and we bought that, and it was going to give us 135,000 square feet, almost twice as much, and 130 underground parking spots, which we didn't have a single one at NPR, and rooftops so we could put our satellite stuff on it because we own the whole building, and a lease for the bank on part of the first floor, which would create some income for us. And I got criticized roundly because now we're got to pay $3 million a year for 20 years, and I left us in debt. Well, yeah, but we're saving probably $500,000 a year. But all they see is what you owe, not mm-hmm. what you save.
Right.
So that was one of the things I was proudest about in being chairman of the NPR board. And I started the NPR Foundation and asked Ed Elson, who was on the NPR board then, and I think later became the Clinton, he became the ambassador to Court of St. James.
We started this conversation talking about Open Line, actually.
I got sidetracked because
that's okay.
Okay.
But this is a tradition that continues today with two-hour talk show, and and you created it in the early 80s.
Yes, and she was really good on that, and she went to NPR, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had, another lady, and she went to be a professor up at Ashland University, I think. And then Fred Anderle had been in the TV department and left us. And Fred took over for Open Line. And at that point, we did 4 hours a day. We did 2 hours of current events, which was what Fred did. And we did 2 hours a day of consumer issues, which Tom Weibel did, and we might do automotive mechanics or antiques or, you know, something like that. But Fred was always in the headline, the current events kind of thing. And Fred was spectacular in his low-key sort of way because he could handle any subject, and he did it in a smooth manner, and disagree with you and you wouldn't dislike him, which was very important on air. And he would sometimes be harsh with callers who, got out of line, and they'd call back next day and be friendly to Fred again. So I know when he left recently, there was a big community show of support for all the work he did. But it was a thing, again, we thought was important on basically a news information station to give the listeners a chance to be involved. This was for their benefit, after all, so they may have something to add. And I think probably Fred may wind up holding the record for length of time in the job because it's very demanding.
Yeah.
And I think probably puts a lot of stress on whoever's doing it.
I think you're right. Other staff that you want to mention that you remember and recall fondly or not so fondly?
Oh,
if you like.
I recall a bunch of them very fondly. I saw one of them today. I don't think he's a day over 90. Tom Lahr, I think he started working here in the 20s. I think when he hit 40, everybody said, years of service, why don't you retire, Tom? Well, he kind of liked working here, you know, so he kept going. I think now he has retired. But
he's coming back part-time.
So he's still
yeah.
coming in.
Yeah.
Ed Clay and Ed was directing our football stuff, and the producer was a guy named Steve Bornstein, and we did all the Ohio State football games from probably in the late 50s until the early 90s. And again, eventually we just couldn't fund it anymore. And now they're all being done anyway, so nobody's losing an opportunity to see the Buckeyes. But Steve Bornstein always wore cowboy boots and a corduroy jacket. And he came in one day and said he got an offer from one of the new organizations. I think this was in 80 or 81, ESPN. And they were really new. And so I said, well, just be careful, Steve, because, you know, they could go under or they could grow. You don't know. He left us, went to ESPN. And I think after a year or two, he was head of collegiate sports. And then after 4 or 5 years, he was vice president for programming. And then after 10 years, he was chairman of the board. And then when Disney bought him, ESPN was just going dynamite. And I saw Steve in New York a couple of times in his $2,000 Brooks Brothers suit. Didn't look like the same guy. Didn't have on cowboy boots and didn't have on his corduroy jacket. And he told me, I teased him about it. He said he was more comfortable when he was working here. But Eisner made him move over to president of ABC, which he did not want to do. And I think he served as president of ABC for a year, and he left the Disney organization. I think he's now with NFL Films or something. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that gave me an opening to move Ed Clay up. And then when Mike Motler left us as TV manager, I moved Ed up to TV manager. And just solid as a rock, you know, he knew everybody, and he played in his own band and keyboard, and he hours didn't seem to bother him. His wife was an executive, I think, with AT&T, and so they were a very highbrow kind of family in terms of, moving around and on the go all the time, and they had a wonderfully bright daughter. Sherry Walker was our chief financial officer, and Sherry was just wonderful. There was never a financial situation I had to worry about because she knew where the numbers were, and you just couldn't pull anything on Sherry. There were quite a lot of other people that, you know, look, Fred Anderle, and we went to China and did programs in China. And Fred was part of that group. Larry Reynolds was part of that group. And Ed Thompson, who I think I saw in here earlier today. I'm surprised he's out of jail, but he was in here. But there were so many things that happened over all those years that I got fond memories of really hundreds of people, when you include staff and the Friends Board. There's probably 100 different people serving on the Friends Board, and almost all of them I liked very much and appreciated what they were doing and had some, you know, personal activity with. I remember when Ken Cookson and I were in Washington in a meeting, and he was president of the Friends Board, local attorney, and he was amazed at how many people knew me. But, you know, I'd been messing around in the radio TV community for a long time by then, and since the 60s, and knew almost everybody. And, you know, he knew that, you know, I knew some folks, but he was amazed at how many would come up and speak to me and so forth. They're just, almost endless number of people. You know, I think of Friends Board people, and then I think of people who, like Don Davis. this probably doesn't belong here, but his son Kevin was a wrestler at Northland High School, and Spook Beckman was the morning man on WCOL, or the afternoon guy, I guess, rock station. Well, they called down and told Spook, and it was maybe 81 or something, they were going to moon him. Well, it was on the radio. So the police were there. And Kevin got arrested for mooning Spook Beckman on on Broad Street. And it just cracked me up. Don comes in and says, "Oh, Dale, I got to go down and get my son." You know, Don's got such a deep, beautiful voice. And it's funny. I was then at Kevin's wedding later and pulled a trick on him there, and they pulled one on me later, he and his wife. So, it, you know, just a lot of the things. I sort of felt like most of the WSU people were like family members, and so I cared for them like I do family people, and it was reciprocated. It was just a very nice place, and everybody seemed to enjoy each other.
You know, one thing we didn't talk about that was in my notes and I forgot, but you brought it up just now, is family. So tell us about your family right now.
Well, my wife and I have a merged family of my wife, Susan, and she had four kids and I had three. So we have seven kids, and we have 12 grandkids and a great-grandkid. And it's a mass of humanity. And we've had to change some traditions because today, and I'm one of those people that, you know, when you have a mom and a stepdad and a dad and a stepmom, suddenly there's such a demand to be at all these places. We always had Christmas on Christmas Eve, and we have Thanksgiving on the Sunday before Thanksgiving. And so, therefore, they can go to all these other places on those days, and we're trying to stay out of the way. But we get all of them because we're off the beaten schedule. But it's fun, and they grow up, and they don't do what you think they ought to do, and then they do something wonderful, and then they get in trouble. It's just regular family stuff that every family has, but it's kind of warming when they all get together and you feel like, this group is doing okay right now. I just got a couple I got to help and that sort of thing. But we enjoy the family, and we moved in a condo community when I retired. And so we don't have to do yard work. In the summer, we can take the grandkids to the pool and stuff like that. And so it's a more relaxed lifestyle, I think, than when you were working, because you got more time to devote to them.
Right.
And it shows up. One of my little grandkids had to be taken early, and he was like a two-pounder. And we were in Florida, and we came back early, and it was February, so I couldn't play golf. So I just went down to the hospital to the neonatal intensive care unit every day and let him hold my finger and talk to him and stuff. Well, he'll be five in February now, and we are bonded. I mean, and some of the other grandkids will come get in my lap, and he'll come over and remove them. You know, that's his papa. That's But it's like I'm closer to him than the others, but I've seen more of him, and his mom brings him around all the time and stuff. So, and some of the others I don't get to see very much. I got a daughter in Charlotte that I don't get to see very much, and my oldest son's in Montana, and his oldest son has a daughter, and they live in North Carolina on the coast, Morehead City. So I don't get to see them very much. But when I do, it's always wonderful. Just wish it could be more often.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Just a couple more questions.
Yeah.
All right. We're flipping tape. I don't even know.